Welcome to CMA Talks, a podcast for the small ensemble music community, brought to you by Chamber Music America. My name is Nicole Knight, and at the time of listening, I will have just ended my tenure as CMA's Director of Marketing and Communications, but I wanted to get in one last episode before I left. In this episode, we'll hear highlights from the panel Confronting Marginalization Through the Power of the Creative Life, which took place at our Chicago Chamberfest event in June. The panel was moderated by Jenny O'Brown and featured Caitlin Edwards, Alejandra Valerino Boyer, and Blake Anthony Johnson. The event took place at Piano Forte. Later, you'll hear a selection from If Barrels Could Talk by Amina Figueroa. A CMA New Jazz Works commission, If Barrels Could Talk is featured in the CMA Scores section of the Spring 2023 issue of Chamber Music Magazine.
So the title of today's discussion is Confronting Marginalization Through the Power of the Creative Life. And I have to confess that that's a little bit of a mantra just that I carry with me in general. So it's really fun for me to delve into this with these friends today. So I'm going to launch into this discussion with a great question that Alejandra posed, and that is, who gets to decide the definition of excellence and what is it code for? Isn't that a great question?
What I find really limits us as we're talking about excellence and not really digging into what it means and not really maybe challenging ourselves about what that definition is that we leave out a whole group of folks, right? We exclude, I think, a lot of artists who we may not deem excellent because we don't understand their art that they're making, or it is maybe unfamiliar or new to us. And so somehow that just falls unknowingly. Doesn't even have to be malicious, right? But it just falls under like, well, that's outside of the excellence that we're talking about. And I should have also prefaced this with, like, I'm coming really strongly from, like, the classical music perspective, which is where I have lived and breathed as an artist in my life. And so, I pose it as a question, like, who gets to define that? And as a challenge of, like, why? Why does this one person or this one institution get to define what that is? And being really mindful and cautious of, like, is that code to exclude a group of folks? Is that code to exclude a group of artists or a type of art? And so I don't have an answer because I really pose it as a challenge question.
Blake Anthony?
So if I go on stage and the only thing that I'm thinking about is if I play every single note, that's a terrible way to set myself up for failure. But if I go on stage thinking, like, am I going to smile at someone in the audience? Am I going to connect with the piece? Am I going to make the world either internally or externally for the audience be a little bit bigger or brighter? Then artistic excellence is a much more kind of robust animal. And so I think a lot of it is actually a part of the education, especially for students, because I spend a lot more time with the students of, let's really define what that means, because it has a lot more to do with your humanity than anything that you're doing with the instrument as a craftsman.
I just want to piggyback on what you've said and just pivot this discussion, like you were saying, Blake Anthony, to the rising generation and what it means when we're constantly hammering these young musicians with, you have to be excellent and you have to be, you know, you've got to win this and you've got to do that, and what it does to their spirits as well. And to Alejandra's point about, I don't have an answer to this question, we don't really have an answer to the question of what does excellence even mean. So, Caitlin Edwards, tell us about your experience growing up as a young musician in Birmingham, Alabama. How did it shape how you moved through the musical field?
Yeah, well, as you know, Birmingham is a historic city for the civil rights movement. And so, I mean, I remember being in preschool, learning about the history of my ancestors, and even having a grandma who was part of the Children's March, like in the 60s. And so that automatically shaped my viewpoint on the world from a young age. Growing up, I didn't, you know, see many people who looked like me in the symphony. I believe there was one black woman who was possibly the only black person in the Alabama Symphony at that time. And going to different summer music festivals, I would often be one of like maybe five black folks in the place. And so automatically I sought out community, trying to, you know, get with, you know, the folks who looked at me, looked like me, so we could, you know, uplift each other, help each other through some of the craziness that would be happening at some of these festivals. And also as I got older, more news coverage was being had of, you know, the police shootings of black folks. And often I would be in these rehearsals, you know, dealing one, you know, in one sense, I'm in this traditionally white space trying to focus on Beethoven, Mozart, whatever, but also like I'm on social media and watching the news and dealing with that, and also realizing no one else is having to balance this or think about this in this space. And so that made me hyper aware when I would enter into spaces, even just going to a concert, just almost this feeling of having to leave part of myself behind. But going on and connecting with organizations like Sinfonietta or Gateways and my quartet Decompose really helped me form community and I guess kind of not change my mindset, but become stronger with the thought that all of these parts of me culturally, musically, they make me the musician I am today. So you can't really hide that. So yeah, that's how Birmingham shaped who I am as a musician today.
And how important is it to have those spaces where you can be authentically yourself and see yourself reflected in the community around you?
Yeah, it's very important to be able to bring your full self to rehearsals and be able to express yourself and draw out things that you wouldn't normally draw out, like in a regular orchestral rehearsal where we're, you know, focused on the canon. You know, nothing wrong with the canon. I mean, but
everyone always feels like they have to say that.
Okay.
I swear I love Beethoven. It's okay.
But like being with Gateway's Music Festival, connecting with folks who one looked like me, who were in various fields within music, and who were, there's that word again, excellent. But, you know, they were giving it their all, and I was able to connect and hear stories from people who have been in the game, you know, since the 80s, the 70s, but also connect with folks to, you know, bring about a community where I can feel uplifted going into these spaces when they aren't around, learning how to deal with microaggressions. And with Decomposed, it's just like it's a breath of fresh air.
And Alejandra and Blake Anthony, would you guys like to comment on that? Like, how important is it to be able to create spaces where musicians are seeing themselves reflected and in those communities?
Before I took this role, there was no one who looked like me. Now we have six, and now even a black female actually in Virginia now. So I think it matters quite a bit. When you use these words, I really hate template language. So what I mean by that is like equity, diversity, inclusion, and belonging means many different things to many different people. And so I am, you know, even when I send messages, I'm very prescriptive in terms of like when I say equity, I mean X, or when I mean diversity, I mean S. It might be diversity of thought, it might be diversity of people, it might be diversity of you know, demographics. But I think in terms of like what representation means, that's why I'm kind of tripping over this a little bit. It yes, some of it has to do with race, but it's so many other things. So perfect example is I was talking to some students of, you know, some of where my empathy comes from is having a chronic illness that people can't see. And so this idea of how do you relate to other people who might be going through something that you don't know, but really want to share with you, really want to create art with you, really want to create art to make other people feel seen. And so I think representation in all its forms are really important.
Alejandro?
Yeah, you know, the going to the question of are these spaces important, right, to be with people who look like you, come from the same culture or experiences, is that important? Yeah, absolutely, I think so. It's for me, it has been really important. You know, I remember a few years back, right, when we all learned the phrase code switch, right, to code switch, I was like, oh, there it is. That's the explanation of what's been going on, right? Of this idea that at least the way that I had experienced it, right, is I knew the way that I was to behave within white spaces. I talk a lot with my hands. So, you know, I knew, don't do that, Alejandra. Someone's going to call you out. Someone's going to ask you. Someone's going to start mimicking you. Happened my entire life. Okay, I'm sitting with a bunch of white folks. I sit on my hands, right? So kind of like this going back and forth. And what I found was that when I was in these spaces with people who either were Latine or actually, you know, people of color who also understood kind of like this is how I operate within this circle versus how I operate within that circle, a lot of the things that I found, you know, kind of switched and allowed for creativity in a way that didn't in some of these more predominantly white spaces is the burden of teaching is gone, right? I don't need to tell anybody what it's like to X, Y, and Z, or, you know, what it might be like for somebody else, or the burden is, I don't know if it's gone or shared or something, but like it just comes, you know, there's a lightness that comes, you know, with that. The questions that you can ask, that you can explore, you know, the creativity of thought, there's at least, again, this is just my own perspective and these experiences, you know, there's less fear of, ooh, am I going to offend this person? Are they not going to like that I'm talking about this? Is this going to challenge, you know, their norms, the way that they're used to doing these things, and allowed for just a lot more creative conversations and just, you know, kind of messing around with things and being like, I don't know why we do it this way. This is bonkers, you know? And so the spaces, to me, that's what those being in those spaces represent. That's what they allow. They just allow the ability for me to just, I don't know, to just kind of relax, ease in, and not have to be doing that switching back and forth and kind of understanding of like, okay, now I got to navigate this, you know, this culture versus this one. And so I do. I think that there is a lot to be gained in those culturally specific, ethnic specific, racially specific spaces, or whatever your community defining thing is, right? Whatever that identity piece of you is that you feel you do not get on a day-to-day basis or with the, you know, in the normative groups, there's something really valuable to that that for me just releases an ability to just think differently and more freely.
What are ways that we can be intentional in seeking meaningful action?
When I'm talking to other EDs and my colleagues, when they ask me, like, how are you working through this? One is, like, quite simple, or I guess simple in thought or concept, is kind of like reverse engineering your desired outcomes. And what I mean by this is, you know, like, if you're an actual engineer, say you're a mechanic engineer, and you want to see something fly, like, or you want to know how to build something that flies, you typically look up and see what's already flying, and then you try to really figure out, like, how is it able to do that? How do they take off? And you get empirical evidence and data to really back that up. I think in our field, I'm always surprised, like, how often we look for legacy kind of opportunities or issues from within the field. I'm like, clearly we don't know. Like, let's go somewhere else. Let's look up outside of our kind of bubble to figure that out. And, you know, especially that bubble might be international or national or just community. It might be just another sector away. One of the reasons why I love Chicago is because we don't have a dominant sector in terms of how businesses are here. So I love stealing ideas from other sectors and then kind of presenting them to other ones in terms of problem solving. And then the last one, this idea of like having empathy in terms of how people engage with change. change. So there's a lot of people in the world and in the country who they just weren't given these tools to have difficult conversations. You would be amazed how many people cry in front of me, not because they're mad at me, but it's hard and painful because unfortunately it's the first time that someone has had a real conversation and said, I know this is hard, but we still gotta do it. So the empathy part is a big one for me.
Alejandra, as a white Latina immigrant to the US, growing up in a home filled with the folk traditions of Puerto Rico and Venezuela, you have a complex and nuanced perspective on music as a global art form. How have the various musical influences throughout your life become a source of pride for you, but simultaneously within very separate artistic spaces?
Yeah, so this came out of your initial question to us, right? Of like, what was sort of that, I heard it as, you know, what was the defining moment where you kind of understood, right, this whole idea of marginalization within the arts? And the most recent example of like where it just surprisingly hit me last summer, I was in LA and the LA Phil was doing a concert at the Hollywood Bowl, and they were doing a Carmina Burana was on the second half, but the first half of the program was a cuatro concerto. And the cuatro is a traditional instrument of, well, actually both Puerto Rico and Venezuela, but they're two separate instruments. This one was the Venezuelan cuatro. I teared up. I really teared up, and I just sat there in complete awe, not even necessarily because of the music, which was beautiful, not necessarily because of the artist who was like spectacular, but in awe of seeing this instrument on the stage with this incredible orchestra being played in this classical music concert. It was so wild to me to finally see these two things together and to live together. And it's just, it was so powerful because I really did have them so separated. And again, with a lot of pride in both, but this kind of weird, you know, like, well, we know that the classical music's just a little bit more up here because that's what the Europeans do and that's what, you know, people with a lot of money go and see, and so we gotta hold it up here. And man, that's just wild and wrong. Mm-hmm. And so to start seeing these things come together has been really beautiful and really meaningful to me. You know, I'll share just a couple of more anecdotes if I can around
this.
We
have lots of time, so
okay,
please.
Okay, cool. I say cool. Sorry, y'all. but, you know, I also recall, too, I did a lot of work here in Chicago while I was working at Lyric Opera Chicago, of doing these cross-genre pieces with the Latina community, with the Mexican, Mexican-American community, and the Puerto Rican, Puerto Rican-American community. And one of the things that was always surprising to me is how we siloed those works specifically for those communities, right? Right. And what I mean is, these were cross genres. So I had, you know, in one of them, it was mariachi and opera singers. The other one was, it was a string orchestra, but music of Latin American composers, right? And some of it was folk music that was arranged for the string orchestra. The audiences for both of those were always full of Latina people. It was so hard to get the traditional audience to come to understand that this too could be something that could be part of what they would be interested in. Whereas the Latina community, you know, they heard, oh, okay, that's something that's of my culture. It's mixed in with something else. I don't really care if it's mixed in with something else. I want to go see it because I'm so proud of my music. I'm so proud of my culture. I'll go support it in any form that it shows up, right? But we didn't see it the other way around. Mm-hmm. You know, we didn't see it with the traditional audiences. Their first response would be like, that's not going to be my kind of opera. That's we don't really call that opera, do we? You know, and it's like, oh, well, yeah, we could, certainly. And so that's another example for me of how, like, these two things, you know, the harm that we do when we divide them, the richness that can happen when we can connect them, and how, you know, how important it is to also recognize that every community And I'm going, you know, beyond the cultural community. Every community has an art form of its own, right? And being able to embrace that goes back to that excellence question. That is excellent to that community. Who are you to go in and say, no, it's not. Let me show you excellence. It's not your role. That's not your job. These two things can live together. They can coexist.
Absolutely.
That was If Barrels Could Talk by Amina Figueroa. Amina discusses the inspiration for this piece in the spring 2023 issue of Chamber Music Magazine. And now, back to our panel discussion, Confronting Marginalization Through the Power of the Creative Life, from our 2023 Chicago Chamber Fest event at Pianoforte.
Going to the sort of flip side of the concert experience, when we think about audiences and communities, do communities need classical music? And what does that mean for communities that don't prioritize classical music as the sort of preferred musical genre?
Orchestras specifically, I'll just speak for orchestras. We need marginalized communities to survive. Marginalized communities do not need orchestras to survive. I always remind people, because I go to a lot of performances, my secret power is sneaking into places. And I get treated terribly all the time. I tell people that all the time, you know. And the difference is I have a long history with art. So, like, I come back. But I always think about, if this was my first time engaging with this discipline, and this was my experience, I would never come back. And I tell people that all the time. I mean, it is the shock and horror on their faces when they actually realize, like, you know, this is also part of the issue in terms of even before you walk into the hall, you know, how are you treated? How are you looked at? How are you engaged is really important.
Caitlin, do you have any thoughts?
I totally agree. How you're greeted in the hall, whether it's by ushers, like, that totally frames your experience. And I've had several bad experiences as well. In terms of whether communities need classical music, they don't need anything from us. But I feel like as artists, it's our responsibility to share, you know, our art, share what we do, serve the community. I keep saying this, serve the communities that we inhabit. Just because they don't need it doesn't mean they don't deserve to hear it or experience it, you know, in ways. And even, like, you know, going out into communities and bringing your music, it shouldn't feel like a kind of colonizer situation. I think you should really research into the communities in which you want to engage and figure out how you can, I don't know, collaborate with their artists. You know, what's going on, what ensembles, what's their focus in terms of genres and all that stuff. But really just intentionally sharing the art with the communities you want to engage.
Every community, they have their own art. And again, I'm not even saying this in terms of like every ethnic and cultural community. I mean like every neighborhood, every, you know, whatever number of blocks, like there is a very specific art that is of that neighborhood, that town. That's like Chicago's got a specific art scene, right? Like, I mean, it's true in many ways. And so I think if we walk into those conversations of diversifying our audience, right, of community engagement, if we're really thinking about this community building, if we're talking about building community with the audiences that come in who might be new for us and using our, I'm going to keep saying symphony as a tool. I don't run a symphony, but if I did, right, you know, as a tool, to do that, to share, to bring together, and having that outlook on it, as opposed to what I think is ultimately just boils down to scarcity mentality, right? Of, right. Oh my gosh, we need those dollars, we need that audience, we need them to do this, right? Like, step away from that and really think about this being relationship building, about being a sharing, a collaboration.
When we think about the power dynamic within music and how important funders are, which leads me to, it's a perfect segue to my next point. Talk to all of us about what you think about that dynamic. And there are two things that come to mind for me. One is, we all know that there are several major funding organizations that have done like this hard right pivot,
yeah,
and have really dedicated themselves to funding organizations and efforts that are furthering really a greater sense of belonging for all artists. And how is that impacting not only ensembles and organizations, but schools and institutions and even the larger field? And I guess as a question B to that, do we have to have that in place so that we as a musical culture don't rubber band right back to the old way of doing things? Is that potentially, in a sense, kind of holding some institutions accountable that might not want to be held accountable?
Do we need these funders to hold organizations accountable? Yes, actually. I mean, we are still in a capitalist society. Money is what allowed things to work, for better or for worse, right? I think where it falls short when funders do that is when they then don't follow up with an organization as they're making the changes to seem more equitable, more diverse, right, and hold them accountable to the authenticity of that,
right?
Then that's where we start to like get into some really dangerous places, because then it just really becomes performative. The other part that I wanted to answer or respond to in what you were talking about with the way that foundations are approaching that, you know, this thing about access, to me, it goes back to when we're talking about the sustainability of arts equity, and when we talk about BIPOC leadership, right, and especially in predominantly white institutions, it's this challenge of the norm. And you're right, we will go completely rubber band back to that template, right? And it's challenging the way that we normally do things, and it's that fear of change, right? Of like, oh, but if we do this, then what about X, Y, and Z, or how can we truly know? And so, you know, I think for me, I just always want to impress upon folks and to really encourage everybody to challenge that norm. You know, try something new, try something different. Are you going to have to then adjudicate in a different way? Yes, you are. But that's a challenge to you too, right? And so I think the more that we can understand how we've got to change the ways in which we behave, these norms that have just been ingrained in our society, and this goes for all racial ethnic groups. Like, we've all, if we live in America, this has been a thing that has been ingrained in us on how we need to be behaving. Like, we just have to keep challenging that, right? And I think we have to keep it at the forefront and just keep, you know, thinking about it. And that's how we build that sustainability. That's how we really make that change. You can't just be one and done. It's constantly saying, okay, hold on, I'm used to doing it this way because this is the way that I've always done it. What is this person facing? What is it that needs to be done differently to be able to include them into what we're trying to do?
I think it actually brings us back to our original point of, like, what does it mean to be excellent? And what does excellence mean? And redefining that, I think, in a more relevant way. Caitlin, would you like to add to that?
As a artist who applies for grants and individual grants, thankfully, I've had good experiences, you know, applying for these grants, but I've also had friends, you know, who could proofread and do all these things. And I also had a computer and technology that I can use and had access to, and a lot of people don't. So I think it's important that we continue to strive to figure out ways to make applying for these grants more accessible for people who are out there, you know, doing work that needs to be funded.
I have one final request of you guys. So in, let's say, 3 sentences or less.
Oh, boy.
1, 2, 3.
Tell us what gives you hope about the future of our field. I'm kidding about the 3 sentences.
I look at my colleagues and I look at the generation that's coming up behind me and how they are fearless, they're spirited, and they're passionate about what they do as artists, as leaders, as creatives, and how they are creating, you know, avenues for themselves to create art, to make money, and to build their community and invest within their community. So that's what really excites me about the world ahead. And it just shows me that the possibilities are endless. Every time I log online, I'm like, whoa, they're killing it, killing it, killing it. So I'm excited about the future. Yeah,
I have to echo that. I am excited by the changes that have happened, are happening, and will happen. I am excited by the incredible leadership that is starting to emerge. That's really thrilling. I'm excited to see artists having more agency within organizations, presenting and producing organizations, and whatever it is, the pandemic, that caused this like change of tide, I think has been really exciting and thrilling. I'm seeing a lot of, and when I've had conversations, I've exceeded your 3-sentence rule. there's a lot of commas and semicolons here. But when I even have conversations with younger arts administrators who ask these questions, I just think about, like, man, nobody was talking about this when I was coming up through the arts administration, or, you know, even as an artist. Like, we weren't talking about this. I didn't have anybody that I knew that I could go to. And the fact that, like, they're just so fearless and asking the questions and talking, that gives me hope.
Absolutely.
Thanks to Jenny O'Brown, Blake Anthony Johnson, Caitlin Edwards, and Alejandra Valerino Boyed for such an engaging discussion. CMA also thanks the Wallace Foundation for sponsoring this panel, and the team at Chicago's Piano Forte for their help producing this event and recording this discussion. This episode was produced by myself and Orchid McRae, CMA's Associate Director of Marketing and Communications. Thanks for listening.